and the Research Services was formed after the war as an independent, well, as a, yes, independent quotes. A separate company with me as the managing director.
Right. Yeah.
Which had one advantage from, another advantage from my point of view, it meant that one was not nearly so dependent on the clients of the FPE for research. During the war I'd already done some, or directed some research of this kind outside, for example, throughout the war. I directed the Ministry of Agriculture's National Food Survey, which still goes on in almost exactly the same form as I worked out in 1938-39. The National Food Survey in 1982 has just appeared, and it's interchangeable almost in appearance and in method with the very early one. I managed to do several things during the war of that kind. I did a survey. Oh, this might interest you because it's a link. I was asked to do a study of the newspaper reading in the third winter of the war by the British soldier. What did he read in the way of newspapers? So I did the usual thing, drew a sample, drafted a questionnaire, briefed interviewers, sent them out, they interviewed soldiers, and sent the results back, they were tabulated, and then it was given to Allen and Unwin to publish. But since I was technically a civil servant, I couldn't say that it, you know, during my spare time I also did surveys for other people, so I had to invent a name. And it was published under the name of Philip Kimball.
Great.
It seemed to me sensible,
it's very
and clever, attractive solution to me. And somewhere now there must be a copy of it around. But,
good Lord. Fancy doing all that work and then having to publish under a pseudonym.
Yeah.
You must have been a bit fed up about having to
Never worried me.
You also, I mean, in 1951 you published a book on social survey.
Yeah.
Social survey.
Social survey, social action.
Right. How did you
find time to write it?
Well, find time to write it, but also what made you want to write
it? Well, I was asked to go to the University of Chicago as a visiting professor of social research. I found that what this meant was taking a seminar once a week, once a fortnight, and talking about how you do survey research, what the difficulties are, other techniques of doing research, and so on. And when I first went there, I said to the president of the college, you know, once a week, that's not much of a teaching load, is it? And he said, oh, you don't know our students. It's a week's work to prepare a lecture that will satisfy them. He turned out to be right.
Really? Why?
Oh, yes. I remember the first lecture I gave was on research for the welfare state. And then I said, well, you know, any question, we were sitting around a big, large table. And the sort of questions they fired at me was, well, that was interesting. Have you read so-and-so? And I said, no, I'm sorry, I haven't read it. They said, oh, Then the next question would be, well, what about so-and-so? Have you read that? And my answer would again be, well, no, I haven't got round to that. They had read much more than I had. And when there were ever any absentees, the alibi given me always, not the alibi, the explanation given me always was, well, he, she had to see his, her analysis, analyst this morning. Oh, they were real high flyers. Yeah.
It sounds appalling.
But anyway, after a while, I found I could cope and needed something to do.
Mm.
So I wrote this book, Social Survey, Social Action, and it was published here, and it was, in those days, a great success. I think Heinemann sold 8,000 copies. Up till then, I'd never heard of any book of that kind being sold at 8,000 copies. And it was reviewed in America. I remember Morris Janowitz reviewing it and saying, the flavor of Fabianism, unfortunately, is to be discovered through all this book. It's all about, you know, policy making for the welfare state. You know, that was, it was published, and again they asked me a few years later to revise it, bring it up to date, and I said yes. And at the end of the year they said, look, Mark, you still haven't sent us even a synopsis. And I said, oh, maybe next week. And they said, don't be silly, you mean never. And I said, all right, never.
But it became a sort of a handbook, didn't it?
Yes, very widely read. But I'm saying one of the advantages of having research services after the war as a separate company was that one could undertake not only work for government departments, some of which was extremely interesting, but one could even undertake work for competitors of the London Press Exchange.
Mm.
They didn't mind in the least.
Right.
You know, I would undertake work for National Benzol, which was an LPE client, and simultaneously for Shell, because they didn't mind either.
Yeah.
But some of those early post-war surveys were very interesting. The one, for example, on the productivity of British labour in the construction of the Fawley refinery, where what happens, the Americans, Esso, planned this refinery on the assumption that you would need a minimum of 3 British workers to do what 2 American workers would do. They thought they were being optimistic about that. And then suddenly they found the thing was going to be finished on time. Better than on time, if anything. So would I do a survey to find out why? These clowns were behaving in such an un-British way. And the answer was simple, the quality of management. That any British firm they'd gone to, the management was sitting in the Dorchester. You know, and they wouldn't go near the site at Fawley. Whereas the Americans, they were on the site, they were there at 8 o'clock in the morning, their door was always open. If there was any difficult job, difficult in the sense that it was technologically newish to the British workers, they would say, fine, we understand why it's difficult, you were trained as welders, but welding for a refinery is different, we appreciate that. In 2 weeks, we can give you the necessary training. And I said, 2 weeks? An apprenticeship in this country is 5 years. And Bob Cole, the American in charge, would say, well, maybe it is 5 years, but you'll be expert refinery welders in the end of 2 weeks. And they were. Or they said they wanted tea in the afternoon. And how could you get tea? There was no water supply laid on the marshes there. That's okay, I'll get a water pipe laid on. there'll be a tap, you have to boil the water, but there will be boiling water. And it was within a week.
Very efficient and
intense. And he persuaded me, he said, look, I give you an extra, I don't know what was, tuppence an hour, if you will agree to interchangeability of jobs. That if there's nothing for this crew to do, but there is a lot to be done there, then you all, both the incoming and the ones who will be there, will get an extra tuppence an hour if you shift. And you said, fine, okay. So it's the attitude of management. And also, if there was any dangerous work to do, one of the American managers would say, look, we're going to put this on flare tonight. And when you put rig on flare, it can be dangerous. It usually isn't, but it can be. So we will handle it. So, you know, one explained. It's a question of the competence, the attitude, the relationship of the British management. You know, I remember one of the men, as I interviewed a lot of the men, one of them saying to me, you know, I tell you, you get your self-respect back when you work for someone you respect. And if you work for someone you don't respect, then you're ashamed of what you're doing. And that was it.
So, I mean,
that was the sort of job, you see, that came along.
But at the time, that was presumably rather, it was not a popular message. I mean, to say things like management were incompetent.
But it wasn't popular.
Did you actually try and publicise that?
It was published as a small book. It had a joint author, an American woman called Gray, who had worked with Merton in America, passing through England, stopped, and we worked together on this. It was published, and I got invitations from a few branches of the Electricians Union, because they'd been closely involved in this, to go around and talk to some of their groups, which they organized to listen to this, and to talk to productivity teams, which the country was bursting at the seams with people calling themselves productivity teams.
It's time and motion sort of thing.
Yeah, and all waiting for trips to America.
Right.
You know, to talk to them. I did, I lectured to them. So that was sort of thing that happened. And then when NEDI was set up, they also wanted to know why on earth people went out shopping and they were offered good, fine, solid English glassware. And they said, no, they preferred, haven't you got any Swedish? Haven't you got any Danish glassware? Or they were offered British crockery and they said, haven't you got any German crockery? Yeah. Why was it? Why did this happen? So I said, well, the easiest thing is to ask the retailers. They will know why they don't place their orders with them. So we did about 13 different industries. And I remember the one on cameras, because at the end of the war, British manufacturers of cameras had a monopoly. There were no other cameras available in this country. And then Japanese cameras began to come in. And I finished the report and I said, well, look, what the buyers in the retail stores say is that the Japanese camera is technically very much better, that it's much easier to handle, even for good technicians, it's much easier to handle a complex English one. And they get better deliveries even from Japan than they get from British manufacturers. And I had to give this presentation to the little lady that was concerned with the camera industry. And the spokesman for the British camera manufacturer, said, I can tell you something. First of all, what these people are telling you is lies. And secondly, I can tell you this. The Japanese camera manufacturers will be bankrupt in 3 years' time. They're not bankrupt yet. But the English manufacturers
are all bankrupt, yeah.
Yeah.
So let's just sort of find out where we are a bit more. And Philip must have been coming up to